From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest, writer-producer Tim Kring, has jumped quite a ways from Crossing Jordan to his newest, latest, and most fascinating series, Heroes, which is now in its third season on NBC. I can't think of another show that blends comedy, drama, melodrama so well as this show. And Tim, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
And I got to think part of the show is, too, just based on what you've done in the past between Strange World and Crossing Jordan, you want to try something that was a bit more complicated.
I also had been working within the, you know, the form of a procedural closed-ended storytelling. And, you know, so many of us who do that long for, you know, these much longer arcs of stories rather than having to do what is, you know, usually an artificial kind of version of storytelling where you wrap everything up within an hour.
Because one of the things I love so much about Heroes is that each narrative feels like a different kind of thing. For example, Hero could be the character Hero, I should say, could be right out of manga or anime, the way the story is told. The colors are different. The emotional coloration is different to the Petrelli story, which is almost like something out of Russian literature.
You know, I think a lot of that came from my background as a freelance writer. I would juggle four or five assignments a year writing, you know, any number of different genres, and I kind of developed this very short attention span for what I was doing, and so I'd get bored doing the same thing over and over again. When I went first to series television and joined the staff of Chicago Hope, I remember when I started writing the second episode that I was writing, I had this overwhelming sort of pang of, haven't I done this already? Didn't we already do the surgery scene where she asked for this particular instrument? And a lot of the narrative structure of Heroes is born out of this idea of wanting to, you know, this short attention span that I have. That particular aspect of the first season came out of a desire to make sure that you knew where you were. So every story had its own sort of look. We used a very saturated colors for a story that took place in L.A. New York always had a kind of steel blue quality to it. We had a storyline that took place in Las Vegas that was, you know, at least a stop overexposed and always sort of blown out. Texas had a kind of yellow filter to it, or as we called it, a urine filter number one. And and we really just decided that it was a part of keeping everybody straight as to what story line they were in.
But it's interesting, too, because I wonder how you go into a network and say, I want to do a show, or do you say this? I mean, because the show is really about, we can say for people who don't know it, about a group of strangers discovering these powers that they have and how these powers essentially wreck all their lives, really about the burden of being a superhero in some ways. How do you pitch something like that and then say each narrative arc is going to have a very different storytelling style?
Well, I mean, I pretty much pitched it exactly as you did.
You stole my idea, man.
Absolutely. And so that was, you know, that they took a flyer on that was actually pretty amazing. And I think I attribute a lot of how the show got on the air to the fact that I was doing this other show at the time. I was doing Crossing Jordan. And so I could kind of hide behind, you know, the showrunner duties of always being too busy to answer specific questions about what I was doing on this project of Heroes. And so in some ways, I think it slipped, you know, in between certain development cracks that are usually there when a show is developed, just by virtue of my day job.
But part of this for me seems like, and you can answer this as somebody who's run a couple of shows, that you can kind of detect a hunger for something that's not being served. It partially came, too, from the fact that superhero stuff in the last 10 years has done so well film-wise. I mean, it was a perfect time to sort of pitch something like this after the success of the X-Men movies, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was that. And in many ways, in more ways, I think it was the idea of a large ensemble serialized drama that NBC did not have on the air. So I kind of saw that was a missing piece of their slate. And so I kind of came at it from that end. And you have to remember we came after 1 year after Lost actually was on the air. And both Lost and shows like 24 had really taught not only the audience but the networks how to do a show like that with a large cast where you frequently kill off characters that people have gotten used to. And
yes, in your case, very frequently kill off characters.
Right, exactly.
That people have gotten used to.
and so this was something that I think these shows actually taught the networks as much as the audience how to do. And coming in with that kind of an idea first off, I think was I'm sure they had a harder time than we did.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Tim Kring, the creator and executive producer of Heroes, which is now in its third season on NBC. One of the things, though, you're talking about following in the sort of footsteps of Lost and certainly 24, but I wondered if Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable in some ways was an influence on you, too, because this show is really about the emotional burden of having to deal with the kind of powers that separate you from everyone else.
Actually, there were two movies that I saw back to back that started playing off in my mind. Literally, they were completely different kinds of movies, but I saw them on two separate, you know, like a Friday and a Saturday. It was The Incredibles, and then Charlie Kaufman's Unbearable Lightness of Being. Eternal Sunshine. Exactly. Both of those started playing off of one another in my mind, and. In some ways, the Kaufman-esque characters, these very hyper-anonymous characters that you pass on the street and never think twice about, that were going through extraordinary things, that started to kind of seep into my subconscious. And that, along with the idea of The Incredibles, of people living, trying to live lives without anybody finding out what was going on with them, it was really those two I think that I was thinking about more than anything else.
One of the things that I find so interesting is that it really does feel novelistic, and using that kind of expansiveness must have been key to you in conceiving the show, because by the end of the fourth episode, we're looking at a different show.
Yeah, I was really interested in following a kind of model of what happens next. That was something that was very interesting to me, of just constantly asking that question, okay, now what? Now what would happen? And, you know, I was kind of influenced by the kind of Dickens way of telling stories, where you tell a story, you know, he wrote many of his novels as one chapter installments in the newspaper. And I became really fascinated with that idea of just sort of not knowing exactly where you're going, having big tent poles of where you want to end up with each story, but letting sort of iteration and surprise sort of get you there.
And also, you got into the habit very early in the show of introducing characters and not explaining their backgrounds.
I felt very strongly that audiences nowadays more than ever need much less explanation of what's going on and who somebody is. They'll put things together in ways that you know, are usually correct if you let them. And I think anybody who's done a television show realizes, you know, 2 years into the show, you'll do an episode that out of nowhere, you'll look at it and go, you know, this could have been the pilot, and we could have gotten all of the same sense of relationships of everybody, but we're 2 years into the show, and we could have started the show here, and it would have been really interesting because all the nuances are there, and we're not hitting people over the head and explaining things. And so I really felt like dropping people in to a crisis situation where you didn't do the first act of setup was something that I was really interested in.
Well, this season's storyline, villains, could easily have been the pilot as well.
That was kind of the idea, is that you know, one of the things that we've really been playing with on the show is this idea of volumes rather than seasons. The first season just happened to be one volume long, and or the first volume just happened to be one season long. the second season that was sort of truncated by the writer's strike was meant to be three volumes. Well, you know, the first was 11 episodes, and then I think there was seven, and then six would be the third. This particular volume, Villains, is 13 episodes long. And the idea is, because serialized storytelling is so difficult on television because you want to avoid the pitfalls of having to drag a tremendous amount of story behind you when you're telling these stories, because it becomes really impenetrable for an audience to find their way into these kinds of stories. So the way around it was to do these smaller volumes that can have a beginning and a middle and an end and answer, you know, 90% of the questions that you pose, so that you can start afresh and get people interested in the show who may or may not have ever found the show. And so the third season, having been off the air for 9 months, it was really important that we start in a way that was that felt like it was pretty fresh. It's very energizing for everybody who works on the show as well to suddenly launch into these new volumes.
It's a treatment. I'm talking to Tim Kring, the creator and executive producer of Heroes, which is now in its third season on NBC. Because one of the things, as I watch the show, I find myself thinking that TV, series television now, is and lends itself to repeated watching. And I almost feel like Heroes is one of those shows that grew out of that understanding that, you know, at some point people are going to have different technologies to revisit the show, be it their iPod or iTunes or having the show on DVD. I mean, that's the real 21st century innovation of the show to me. It feels like it's a show that demands that you watch each episode more than once.
Yeah.
That must have been some consideration to you.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's obviously a tremendous amount of clues and information that we designed to be able to set your DVR and stop it and go back. And we've also found that, you know, the streaming of the show online is very often the same people who, when they watch it with commentary, they're the same people who watched it without commentary. So people are definitely having repeat viewings. And then clearly they're buying the DVDs as well. So, yeah, no, and it is, as you said, this show here is very much at the forefront of, I think, this whole new paradigm shift of how people are watching television, especially the demographic that's interested in this show, a younger, more computer-savvy, internet-savvy audience.
Because you were saying attention spans have changed. I think you're right about that. But devotion to specific shows has changed. I mean, you know, what you've done and coming in, you know, in the wake of 24 and Lost is be part of this movement that has created a whole new generation of obsessives who live with these shows in the way they never have before.
Right. And there's a very interesting relationship that a show like this has with its audience. It's a very fragile, tenuous thread that connects us to this fan base. Very passionate fans can cut both ways. They can be very passionate for you and very passionate against you. You really get the sense it's kind of a gladiatorial event, and each week is either a thumbs up or a thumbs down. But this very thin thread that connects you is held by a certain amount of authenticity, and the audience wants to feel that they are being authentically spoken to by the show. You know, it becomes really important to us that everything that's put out about the show and everything that sort of speaks to the brand of the show always feels like it's coming from, you know, the creative forces of the show. Otherwise, it feels like they're starting to be spoken to by some big corporate entity, and they can reject that. But that thin thread that connects us can be severed by all kinds of things. And, you know, one or two episodes that people don't like can turn things very quickly.
One of the things that I was struck by, and just like looking at some of the message boards and that kind of stuff about the show, is that people, in this weird way, wanted it to be the same show that it was in the first season, but wanted it to be something very different. And you must be in that position of feeling, wait, we can't serve two masters here.
Absolutely. And there is that constant tug of people wanting the same, but they will kill you if it's the same, or they'll you know, in many ways, the first season had a very similar arc to the second season. When I first logged on to the chat sites about 8 episodes into the first season, there was violent reaction against it of when are these characters going to come together, and this show's going to disappoint us just like all the other shows, and I'm I'm out of here. I'm not watching anymore. And then 3 or 4 episodes later, everything had turned. And so, you know, you sort of have to let this thing unfold the way it's going to unfold. The whole picture can't be told unless you stick with it. You're just never going to get the whole picture.
We'll take a break and come back with my guest, Tim Kring. He's the creator and executive producer of Heroes. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I have no powers. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is the creator and executive producer of Heroes, Tim Crane. One of the things I was really struck by in this third season is that you really treated it as a kind of a literal rebirth. I mean, there's so many characters who we thought had died or in peril at the end of the second season. Again, your abbreviated second season, which you brought back into the show in very different and really frightening ways.
We had always actually planned on bringing a few of them back, but some of them are literally cast available and actor available. Somebody like Malcolm McDowell, when he became available to us again and it became a possibility to have him back, we decided to try to find a way. And anybody who's really watched the show closely over the two seasons has seen that the show has these very unique ways of bringing people back. We have the past and we have the future, and like they said in The Princess Bride, you're only mostly dead on Heroes.
That's one of the things, though. It seems like in some ways you use the show as a way to sort of, because obviously you're a fan of television, use it to comment on the form in a way that people generally don't.
It feels like the form, is at a place now where people are so self-referential about television, and it becomes such a part of the lexicon that it's sort of, I think it's logical to start turning those things on itself and start pointing up, sort of playing with the actual format of how we've been watching TV all these years.
Because one of the things that sort of strikes me about the show, too, is that there seems to be a real politics involved in it, just about how, basically interfering with the natural world has serious consequences.
There's definitely that. There's this sort of science, the dangers of getting into science. But the first real political, I guess, overtones of it were really just about global consciousness. It was really trying to make a statement about us being all connected, and it was part of why I wanted to have a big international feel. The premise of the show was that this was happening all over the world, and it just would have felt kind of strange and disingenuous to just have it happen to blonde-haired, blue-eyed people in Southern California. And by extension, that message of global consciousness was something that I really was very, very interested in putting out there, this idea that we're all connected and that if we can find each other and work together, we can actually do great things.
But it's also about how diminished in size the world is now. And in the early episodes of the third season, you literally have Mama Petrelli mention the butterfly effect.
And, this idea of the world being very small is definitely commented on all the time and is sort of, exemplified by Hiro Nakamura's ability to just sort of pop in and out of any part of the world that he wants to. And, we use it as a way to that particular character as a way to do a kind of global view of the show. It's something that couldn't be done literally, up until a few years ago with the advent of cheaper special effects. We can now do these incredible virtual sets with green screen backgrounds. And this was something you couldn't do on a television budget until very recently.
But you also have something that we basically until last we hadn't really seen much of, which is having a major character speak almost all of his dialogue in subtitles.
Right, right. And again, I really wanted to speak to this idea of it being a global idea. And again, it felt odd to me if I had a story that took place in Japan, which the pilot story for Hiro Nakamura all took place in Japan. It just seemed very strange that these people would speak English. And we talked a lot about the subtitle fatigue and how much subtitles would a normal audience really tolerate. And I think we've sort of shown that people really are willing to read subtitles on an American television show.
Well, part of this, too, has to come for you from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which showed that a subtitle action piece could resonate with a larger audience.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think these movies made their way into the mainstream audience of American audiences, and I think TV was sort of the last to come to that.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Tim Crane, who's the creator and executive producer of Heroes. But again, so much this season, we can't get you to give away too many things, although if you want to give something away, I
sure
wouldn't be averse to having you do that. But it sort of scares me a little bit because the tones of the individual stories have started to bleed together if you forgive that messy metaphor, in this season in a way that they had not before.
Yeah, we chose not to have what we did in season one and season two is have these very divergent storylines, these very different and disparate storylines that then came together. And part of the fun of the first season, I think, was trying to figure out how these stories were going to cross and how someone like Ahiro Nakamura was going to get together with a cheerleader in Texas. And it was part of the participation of for the audience was to try and guess and predict and all of that. And but I think we really set the challenge this year to try to eliminate a kind of act one that you would normally have and drop right into, you know, the act two of the story. And tell every single story is actually connected to this one very big story. The big story being that there is this formula that has been seen now to replace the idea of evolution as the source of these powers, and every single one of our characters is involved in that particular storyline,
including giving powers to a character who's. Individuation kind of consists of the fact that he didn't have powers.
Right, right. And, you know, part of that is that it is one of the challenges of serialized storytelling is that your characters just have to change and they have to grow when you're telling a serialized story. In a closed-ended storyline, as long as, you know, the two cops are actually solving the crime at the end of the show, they don't necessarily have to change. But a character like Mohinder Suresh, who had been on the outside as this sort of scientist looking in,
But also like an audience surrogate in some ways, he seemed to me.
Yeah, yeah. And I just sort of felt like we had taken that to a place of frustration. I think he wanted to step a little deeper into the mythology of the show. And, you know, one of the things that I'm never afraid of and the writers on this show are never afraid of is doing something like that because we've created a world where there's ways to, you know, paint yourself into a corner and then, you know, paint yourself out with all of the various avenues that we can go in this kind of genre. In other words, Mohinder Suresh having powers doesn't have to be permanent for us.
I mean, there is a morality in the show and I think a pretty interesting kind of Dickensian politics, you know, about the real world versus being isolated from that world. I mean, be that in the case of Nathan Petrelli, who separated himself from the earth and the consequences. But there's very much about either being earthly or being removed from that and the danger of that, too.
Well, you know, the show has posited all sorts of different theories about what this is about. And, you know, the one that I think floats in and out quite a bit is the idea of the spirituality of the possible divine quality that these powers may have, and it's something that the show actually touches on quite a bit. There's a fair amount of discussion about God in the show that I think is a fascinating part of the whole equation.
Well, there's a Keats poem in one of the early episodes of the season. I thought of another line from Keats as you were talking about this, which is one of the poems he talks about is if someone had swallowed an angel and it's more than he could contain.
Huh. And in this first episode, they actually for the first time bring up the possibility that maybe they're angels.
But the religious aspects really have sort of come to the fore in these first few episodes, right down to having your invulnerable cheerleader say, if you can't feel, do you have a soul?
Right, right. And Nathan Petrelli, who is, you know, the politician and in some ways the most morally liquid, actually finding God and trying to, you know, deciding that perhaps he has some greater purpose in life.
Well, it's a death and a spiritual and literal rebirth for him.
Exactly. He literally dies and comes back to life and comes back to life with a newfound purpose.
It's a treatment. I'm talking to Tim Kring, the creator and executive producer of Heroes. So, as you were talking about, you know, the second season, one of the things that happens, and we had a number of creators come here and tell us about that, is when they try to introduce new characters in the second season, there is a vehement reaction on behalf of audiences to those.
Yeah, which I was really – I had always envisioned this show would be able to reinvent itself on a constant basis.
And I assume that you want to use the show as kind of a – a foundation to invent new characters all the time and change the emotional mix of the show.
Absolutely. I was actually most fascinated by the origin part of the story. this idea of people coming into, you know, first blush of these strange occurrences that are happening to them. That to me was the fascinating part. And then how, you know, if you are single and you're dating and you have a sick mother, or you have a job that you hate and a rent that you're trying to pay, and on top of that you discover you can walk through walls. That to me was the interesting idea of the show. And once you now have characters that then start to become in full possession of these powers and in full command of them, then their needs change and the existential questions of what's happening to me and why get replaced with sort of plot questions of, you know, what I'm doing with these powers. And to me, those are not ultimately as interesting. And so the challenge for a show like this is to find ways to strip away those plot questions and come back to the primal questions of the show of who am I, what's happening to me, how am I connected. And in many ways, that's what this Volume 3 Villains did. It took all of those questions, those primal questions, and sort of turned them on their head with the introduction of, you know, everything you thought you knew about where these powers came from and how you were connected to these people, all changes in this particular volume.
But the one thing, too, getting that question that I always thought the show was about that you just mentioned here is that one person can make a difference. In this case, that one person can make a difference, unfortunately, in the other direction,
yeah,
too.
No.
It's not always a good direction.
Yeah, and I was always interested in that idea of what would you do if you had these powers. And it's kind of predicated on what your situation in life is and where you are. And if you can walk through walls and you are predisposed to be good, then you may walk through a wall to save somebody's life. If you're predisposed to do bad, then you may walk through a wall to rob a bank. And so that idea of free will and your circumstances plays into this. And it just seemed like we needed to get to this volume where we would ask that question of each one of our characters as to what are you willing to do with these powers and where is your base nature? Are you good or are you evil?
Well, Tim, thanks so much for doing this. You've got to come back again. I'd love to have you come back.
Terrific. I'd love to.
My guest is Tim Kring, the creator and executive producer of Heroes, which is now in its third season on NBC. Our recording engineer at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Leszek Wojciech at Carnegie Recording Studios in New York. Bob Carlson is the editor. Jemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.